the T-Dot. Reppin' everywhere I go. Everybody from the cold. This is where we call it home. Jungle, Vaughn Road, Malvern, Chester Lee, Rexdale, let the fire burn. John Garland, Flemo, stand up. If you're from Toronto, let me see you put a hand up. Born alone, die alone, but I'm never on my own. No watch, no face, stay true is what I was shown.
Hi, I'm Jim Grierson.
And hi, I am Will Leach, and this is the Grierson Leach Podcast, episode 33. Of the Grierson Leach Podcast here on the New Republic. Grierson, it was a Labor Day weekend. I'm a big fan of Labor Day. I feel like it's generally an underrated holiday. Most people get more excited about Memorial Day because it starts it into summer. I tend to like fall more than the summer. So therefore, Labor Day is finally, after everyone else has been spending the summer just relaxing and just going outside, I'm so excited for Labor Day to get here. So all the people that have been trying to get to work at the speed that I've been working all summer are finally back in the office.
So it's basically like a petty, vindictive kind of reason for why you feel that way.
No, listen, I love working. I'm not it's not like I'm mad at them.
You're like that's right. Taste my blood. Now you know it.
Yeah. Like, no, I'm happy that I'm having a great time working. It's that I feel like everyone else slacks off over the summer. And of course, one man's slack off is another man's go enjoy the life and all the earth has to offer. But to me, it's a come on, let's get back to work like we're supposed to be. So, but nevertheless, the one thing I do miss from Labor Day, and I will end it here. Do you remember the story about how Jerry Seinfeld used to, every Labor Day, he would host a big party and everyone would come over and watch the Jerry Lewis telethon? Do you know that story?
I don't know that. It's funny. I was thinking of another Seinfeld story when we were talking, but not that one. No.
Yeah, that was he used to do. Of course, they don't do the telethon anymore. And though he may have to come back to it after Max Rose appears to not be very good. But Jerry Lewis, Jerry Seinfeld found it such a, you know, it's Seinfeld. So it was probably kind of like, it was really funny and also kind of like dickishly ironic. And he would have people come over and they would all just mock all the horrible acts that they would have for the Jerry Lewis telethon while hopefully still giving money to like, make themselves feel better for mocking this thing that, as for all of Jerry Lewis's blowhardedness, did actually help a lot of people. So worth keeping in mind. Anyway, this is the Grierson Leach Podcast, episode 33, the Larry Bird edition. We remind you, as always, to please subscribe to us on iTunes and find us on SoundCloud at thenewrepublic.com. And make sure when you go to iTunes or SoundCloud, I should remind people that you can review us on SoundCloud. If you do that and give us a nice review of the name of a movie, we will review the movie that you would like us to talk about in our reboot section. This week, we have two movies in our reboot section. The first review comes to us from M Machu B 93. Again, I guess Machu B 93 was taken. I couldn't have 92 or 94. Maybe he's a fellow 1993 graduate like us, Grierson.
Possibly, yes. I don't know this gentleman. I'm going to assume it's a gentleman. I don't know. Maybe it's a lady.
It could be. It's all sorts of possibilities. It's an endless stream of possibilities. But I'm not sure about Machu B because here's his subject. Two buds who love movies and each other. That's a little bit more personal. You're doing a lot. You're very presumptuous, Machu B. Well, are we buds? Sure. Am I ready to use the term love? I don't know. Let's give it another 30 years.
Yeah, let's see. But it's a good tagline for the podcast. So I thank Mr. 93, Mr. or Mrs. 93 for that.
Yes, yes. Two buds who love movies and each other. That's like the saddest tagline to like Clerks 80. Okay, anyway, here's this review. This is one of the few film review podcasts I anticipate every week. Both reviewers are fair and fun to listen to. Even the worst movies get credit where it's due. I recommend this podcast to my, quote, film friends, as well as my other friends who are more casual film goers like myself. And his review is Terry Gilliam's 12 Monkeys. So in our first section, in our reboot section, we will discuss Terry Gilliam's 12 Monkeys. The second movie comes to us from Dasha in London. Can you do a London accent for us, Grierson?
No. Wait, can you?
Very
can you,
good.
Can you do one? Can you do one?
Well, I'm sorry. I actually thought that was you doing one.
Oh, it was seamless. No, can you do one? Yeah. Like, can you actually do a good one? That's the question.
Yes. Okay, so now we go over to my, Dash in London says, this is my favorite podcast, 5 stars. Dasha writes, first found out about this when my husband was listening to it in the car, and I've been hooked ever since. Grierson and Leach occupies that middle space between podcasts which are overly pretentious and those which are simply recaps of the movie. This is more like a casual conversation between friends about the latest and sometimes older films, discussing the themes and overall quality of the movies in a way that is accessible to everyone. I really like Dasha from London.
This is one of the nicest reviews. I really appreciate this. Thank you very much. Yeah.
For the reboot, I'd love to hear a discussion of John Carpenter's Escape to New York, though I think it's Escape from New York, but I'm not going to call that out, Dasha. I just did, sorry. It was a favorite from my childhood, but I doubt it would live up to today, although I could see it getting a Mad Max-style reboot with someone like Charlize Theron, Angelina Jolie, or Emily Blunt as Snake Plissken, Viola Davis as the president, and maybe even Kurt Russell in the Lee Van Cleef role. I would have picked Shakes the Clown, but it was already selected by someone else. That's strange. I'm surprised to hear that. But nevertheless, thank you, Dasha from London. We will be talking about John Carpenter's Escape from New York. But first, because we have no major releases to talk about this weekend, though, Gerson, I feel like I should ask you very quickly, because the number one movie in the country, we have not talked about yet. Have you seen it? It's the, what's the name of the big scary movie that's scaring movies, people all across the country?
It's called Don't Breathe. I have not seen it yet. If I had more time this weekend, I would have checked it out. But I've heard it's actually really good. So I am curious to check it out. But no, I haven't seen it.
Okay, well, we should. It's a movie we've heard is good, and it's the number one movie in the country. So, well, we should probably talk about it at some point. But first, this week, every Labor Day, other than, of course, us missing Jerry Seinfeld's Jerry Lewis Telethon, a constant in my life, because it's a constant in your life, is the Toronto Film Festival. Grierson is about to leave for the Toronto Film Festival. It's why we're going to be taping two podcasts in like 72 hours to hold us off for the next couple of weeks. So if something happens after next Wednesday, in the next week and a half, just know that we did not realize that, oh, Donald Trump exploded into confetti. Like, who would have seen that coming? And why are Grierson and Leach not talking about that? Well, that would be why, because we're taping a couple real quickly, because Grierson is off to Toronto. And Toronto, you know, we had a preview of before you went to the Cannes Film Festival. But Toronto strikes me, this is the one festival that I would really like to go to. Of all the ones, it's the one I almost went to when we were doing the Yahoo site. I was this close, and then I did not, because Yahoo was a very tiny media company. They did not get to press passes to the Toronto Film Festival because they were kind of up and coming. I don't even know what happened to that company, other than they have a terrible email user that we still use. Regardless, I've never been to Toronto, but it's one I always want to go to, because from what I understand, it is the one that's all about the movies. It's the one where, like, there's not as much showmanship. There's not as much people on the Riviera eating, I don't know, caviar, probably caviar and veal, whatever the animal suffered the most during dying. That's what they're eating in France. But in Toronto, it's all poutine. It's all poutine and milk out of bags. My point is, Grierson, that's how they drink milk in Canada.
It's funny because I was going to just jump in and say that I, to this day, have still never had poutine, and that shocks people. I definitely have never had milk in a bag, though. So
it's a thing. Ask a Canadian. They have milk in bags. The point is, Grierson, Toronto Film Festival, I've never been. I've always wanted to go. We're going to talk about that this week, specifically this year's and your history with it. First off, how many years have you gone to Toronto?
My first year was 2009. So I guess this is my eighth year of going to Toronto.
So is this your favorite film festival?
Cannes is my favorite.
Cannes is your favorite.
Cannes is my favorite. And it's, I have to say, it's really interesting to hear your perception of Toronto, because part of it's right and part of it actually is really different, actually, because there's almost like two festivals, Toronto. One is that there's one theater called the Scotiabank, which is a regular run, hey, anybody in Toronto could go to a movie theater during the year. And that's where most of the press and industry screenings happen. And so for the 2 weeks or so of the Toronto Film Festival, that theater is almost entirely given over to film critics, journalists, people in the industry to see movies. They do some public screenings there, but it's mostly the private screenings. Everything else in Toronto are all these big, crazy galas where you have to have a ticket, and there's not always a red carpet, but often there is some kind of red carpet, and they're pretty starry. You have lots of people walking the red carpets and like that, and even if it's in the rain, which happens sometimes in Toronto that time of year. And those screenings usually start, you know, 20 minutes late. There's big introductions beforehand. The filmmaker comes out, the cast comes out and like that. And so you do have, it's not to the level of Cannes because nothing really kind of compares to how incredibly gaudy and flashy their red carpets are, but you still get a really big emphasis on, if you lived in Toronto or, you know, you live in Athens and you just wanted to go to the Toronto Film Festival, you would buy tickets and go to those screenings and you would see all the stars and like that. So there is definitely a big star contingent, and there is a real emphasis on, look at all the big people we have here to do, you know, be interviewed on the red carpet and all that type of stuff.
But this also seems to be the film festival that you come back and you've seen like four or five movies a day.
Yeah. I mean, I'm, you know, my schedule is sort of interesting, just speaking specifically, is because I review things for Screen International, and oftentimes the public screenings are before the press screenings. And so we actually are kind of dashing from public screening to public screening and waiting forever for them to kind of get started with all the big kind of hoopla and all that stuff. But at the same time, I am seeing about maybe three or four movies a day. So it's a pretty, I mean, I would never, ever, ever speak badly of going to a film festival. I feel incredibly lucky that I go to them. But when Toronto is over, I'm pretty exhausted. I'm pretty tired because as opposed to Cannes, where there's only maybe say four or five or six in quotes major screenings that go on per day, there are dozens in Toronto. And you look at your schedule in Toronto and you have to make choices. There are things that you are simply not going to be able to have time to get to see because you have to see something else in that competing time slot. Toronto is great, but one of the downsides of it is that you go home knowing that there are things that other people got to see that you didn't because you had to make a choice about something else that you wanted to see.
But it's nonetheless important. It certainly seems to me like perhaps the most important film festival, at least on this side of the second half of the year, because it really does seem to kind of set up not just the Oscar race, but really what movies are going to be kind of dominating the conversation for the next 6 months.
Yeah, and I would also say that it's, you know, because Toronto and Venice and Telluride all kind of play at the same time. Venice is first. Telluride happens in the middle of Venice. And then Toronto is right at the end. And Toronto is the place where, and I talked about this a little bit in my New Republic piece that previewed the festival this year. But Toronto, the reason why I love it, and it's the reason why I go to that one as opposed to Telluride or Venice, is because Toronto combines everything. With some exceptions, the big things from Venice, the big things from Telluride, but also the big things from Cannes and also the Berlin Film Festival, also maybe the Sundance Film Festival, all play in Toronto. And so it's the one festival you can go to and feel like, of course, there's just too much stuff to see, but you can say, okay, this is everything. And now that it's, you know, early September going into mid-September, these are the movies that are going to start the Oscar conversation. Now, this year, we've still got other things that are going to be premiering at the New York Film Festival, which is in October. But this really kind of gets the idea going of, hey, summer movie season is over. Now it's time to focus on, you know, the good movies, or at least the Oscar contenders and like that. And so Toronto, there's an excitement of the unveiling of a lot of those types of movies.
All right, well, it's just a relief that the summer movie season is over. That's all. That like there's no Warcraft here. And I know I said I wasn't going to say Warcraft again in a podcast, but you know, it's an itch I just can't help but scratch. So, okay, my last question before we get into this year's specific festival. One thing that I always think about, you know, for me, as many movies as I see, as movies you see, movies are still kind of an emotional thing for me, and I think they are for you as well in a lot of ways. There are certain movies that I will remember where I saw them and when I saw them forever. And like I could, like off the top of my head, I remember, of course, seeing JFK at the Cinema 123 with you in 1991.
Yes.
I remember seeing Shortcuts at the Savoy Theater in Champaign. I remember, frankly, seeing Titanic at the Man theaters in Westwood, right after everyone had decided, right when everyone was convinced it was going to flop, and I saw it, and I was like, holy crap, that movie is not messing around. And you just have certain, they're not necessarily the best movies I've ever seen, but certainly very powerful experiences that you have. Now, A, have you had experience like that in Toronto? And B, if you haven't, what's actually the best movie you've seen in your 9 years in Toronto?
I would say that I have had those experiences. It's not always necessarily the best movie, but the one that immediately comes to mind is, it was 2011, and just to orient people who haven't been to the festival kicks off on a Thursday. But Friday is when the big premieres start to happen. And then Friday, Saturday, and Sundays are kind of the big deals. That weekend is the big weekend in Toronto. On Sunday night in 2011, I went to a public screening at the Princess of Wales Theater. It's this gorgeous theater that's either two or three levels, I forget. And they do other things during the year in Toronto at this theater, but during the festival, it's for movies. And that's where I saw Shame, the Michael Fassbender, Steve McQueen movie. And that had played in Venice already. And because I don't read reviews in advance, I didn't know a lot about it or how people felt. I got a general impression that people liked Michael Fassbender in it. I'm a big Michael Fassbender fan, so I was curious. Movie started, and from the first seconds, I kind of couldn't breathe. I was just so enraptured by the experience of that movie. Now, in this case, you know, you and I, Will, are both big fans of the movie. And for people who have seen the movie, you'll appreciate this, I hope. But when the film was over, I was just completely knocked out and kind of felt like I was floating out of my body. And where I stayed that year, I had to get on the subway. And I live in Los Angeles. I don't use the subway. In fact, the time I use the subway most is in Toronto. So I went down to the subway. It was like 11 o'clock at night. And I was about the only person riding the subway at that time. And all I could think of were all the scenes in Shame where Michael Fassbender is on the subway. Basically, it's the beginning of the movie and the end of the movie. And I feel like I was still inside the movie and the score was still kind of in my head. And that to me is maybe not be the best film I've ever seen in Toronto, but that's the one that I will be seeing movies at the Princess of Wales Theater again this year. Every year since then I've been inside that theater, I think of Shame every single time. I don't sit in the same seat or the same section, but just being in that theater, I always remember the experience. And I've seen really good things since then. I've seen Anomalisa in that house, and I love that movie too, but Shame is the one that's kind of seared into my brain.
Do you think it's the best movie you've seen there? Can you think of what do you think the actual best movie, the one that, if you know, when you're making your best movies of the last 8 years, what's the one that's definitely on that you saw in Toronto first?
Gosh, I'd have to think about that. I think it might be Shame. Shame or Anomalisa, those are two pretty fantastic movies. I would say it's either one of those, probably.
Okay, fair enough. All right, let's talk about this year. Maybe you'll have a Shame or an Anomalisa. The thing the movies have in common, by the way, is cunnilingus, I think, actually. That's the main thing that that movie is
Shocking sex scenes in both movies.
Shocking sex scene, yes, exactly. All right, so this year, obviously, there's tons of movies on this, that are coming out that will be debuting at Toronto or debuted at Telluride or Venice and will be having their kind of North American, the big review, their big debut at this, and most people will be seeing them. I'm curious, is there, before we get into You Are Peace for the New Republic, the 10 movies that you are most looking forward to, I'm curious, industry-wide, is there a movie that is really built up that everyone's like, okay, this, I already know this is going to be the hardest screen to get into?
I think La La Land might fall into that category. That was the opening film at the Venice Film Festival this year. It'll play in Toronto as well. La La Land might be one.
And tell us about La La Land.
Yeah, La La Land is the third film from Damien Chazelle. His last film was Whiplash, the Oscar winner. And this is a big widescreen, old-fashioned Hollywood musical starring Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone as a pianist and an actress who fall in love in Los Angeles. And it's, if anyone's seen the trailers, I mean, it's kind of a knockout. I haven't seen the movie yet, but the trailers are very, I mean, you want to live in the world of that trailer. It's so kind of kinetic and amazing and dreamlike, and it just seems incredible. I think that's probably the one that will be one of the most anticipated. But it's funny because it's not world premiering in Toronto, it may not be the hottest ticket, but it will be one of the hottest tickets. I think that's the one that people are kind of very, very excited about.
And isn't the opening movie, because a lot of times, like, we talked about Rian Johnson and Brick on a previous podcast, but I think like Looper is the one I can remember, the opening night when that really like knocked people out. What's the opening night movie this year? Do you know?
This year it's going to be Magnificent Seven, the Anton Fuqua remake with Chris Pratt and Denzel Washington and Ethan Hawke. Yeah.
I was excited when Looper, I remember when Looper debuted and everyone just like lost their shit about it. I was very excited. And I like the movie a little bit more than you do, but that does seem like a movie that people saw and like just, it just kind of reverberated outward really for the rest of it.
Yeah. And I have to say that in terms of Toronto, what's interesting about opening night films there is that it's really a mixed bag and there's a bit of a reputation that it's, you're kind of like rolling the dice. And that was actually one of the things that was funny about Looper. Out of Toronto, people were like, oh, it's really good. And it was really good for an opening night film in Toronto. Like, we were sort of like pleasantly surprised. So we'll see how Magnificent Seven plays.
All right. So give me, you don't have to go through every single movie that you were excited about seeing that you put on the New Republic list, but give me three movies first off the top of your head, the ones looking over the list that you're most excited about, the ones that you think, oh, I am particularly fascinated about this one, about for the reasons of you're a big fan of the director or it's just an interesting project. Give me three.
Okay. The first one I would say is one that is going to world premiere in Toronto, and it's American Pastoral, which is based on the Philip Roth novel, which I love. I haven't read a ton of Roth, but I've read that one, weirdly enough, on my honeymoon, and I really, really love that book. And it, you know, it stars Ewan McGregor, Dakota Fanning. It's got, you know, this really, really impressive cast. And for people who aren't familiar with the book, I don't want to say too much, but Ewan McGregor plays this man, mid-1950s America, who has kind of what appears to be the perfect life. And it's a portrait of him and his family. Jennifer Connelly plays his wife. Jennifer Connelly's role, I feel like, in movies in the last 15 years is to play the perfect wife. Like, even like in Little Children, she's kind of that way as well. Or even, say, Beautiful Mind, where she won the Oscar. And something happens during the Vietnam era that kind of destroys this man's seemingly perfect family. The book is great. I love the cast. What I'm curious about is that, number one, Philip Roth adaptations don't often go well. This summer's Indignation was kind of a rare exception to that rule, where that movie actually, I think, is pretty darn good. And the other thing is that this is actually Ewan McGregor's directorial debut. I think he's a great actor. We've talked about him on this podcast with Shallow Grave. I like him a lot. But he's never directed a feature before. And that is the one thing that makes me a little nervous, because this is an incredibly difficult undertaking, even for a veteran filmmaker. This is a guy who's acted for over 20 years, but still, this is the first time he's behind the camera. And that doesn't mean it's automatically going to be bad, but it doesn't automatically not make me worry. And so that is one of the great big question marks. Because if that movie is good, I think you can see a lot of kind of Oscar buzz and all that type of stuff. If it's not so good, then people will think, yeah, remember when we were excited about American Pastoral and it turned out to be terrible? And for me, that's one of the things I like most about film festivals, is those big honking question mark movies. And to me, American Pastoral is the big question mark movie of Toronto.
All right, give me two more.
Another world premiere, a documentary, Abacus, the new film from Steve James, the filmmaker who did Hoop Dreams and Life Itself and The Interrupters. It's about this small bank in Manhattan that caters to Chinese immigrants. It was the only bank in New York that was actually nailed by the federal government after the 2008 financial crisis. Because after that collapse happened, there was a lot of uproar, rightly so, in America, that all these, you know, Wall Street fat cats, like, none of them got, there's no jail time, nothing ever happened, they just got these slaps on the wrist. Well, what Steve James has done is he's made this documentary about the one bank that the government actually did go after, this really small family-run bank. And though I haven't seen the movie yet, it's kind of billed as this David versus Goliath story of this small bank that was trying to be crushed by the federal government. That's a different type of movie from Steve James. He's never really done anything exactly in that kind of vein. And so I'm really curious, not just being a fan of his films, but that story seems really interesting. So that's another one that I'm really excited about.
All right, the last one.
The last one is a movie that has played already. It played at Venice. I haven't seen it yet. And it's Arrival. It's the new movie from the filmmaker who did Prisoners, and Enemy, Denis Villeneuve. I think that's how it's pronounced. I'm probably messing it up. But anyway, it's the alien invasion movie done seriously. If you've seen the trailers for it, it stars Amy Adams and Forrest Whitaker and Jeremy Renner as a group of Earthlings who make first contact with these alien vessels that come to Earth. It's a great premise. The trailer looks like a trillion bucks. My reservation about the movie, but again, this is why it makes me more curious, is that he as a filmmaker, we haven't talked about him very much, you and I, in terms of the podcast, but my feeling about him is I think that he is enormously talented. I think he works very well with actors and gets great performances from actors. And that being said, I find his movies more than slightly annoying. And the reason why I do is whether it's Sicario or Prisoners or En Sandie, which got nominated for Best Foreign Language Film Oscar a few years ago, is that they reek of self-importance to me. He is one of those guys who Radiohead songs show up in his movies to let us know that this movie is not a lightweight movie. This movie is serious and it's about serious stuff. My worry about Arrival is that it's going to be the same type of thing where it's, don't you see, the aliens are fill in the blank for some social topic. I worry about that. That's actually why Enemy is my favorite of his movies, because that movie is much more of like a cool, messed up midnight movie vibe. And it has its own kind of pretensions. That movie is more weird and twisted. And I really, really respond to that one in the way I don't his other ones. That being said, the alien invasion movie is kind of in my wheelhouse. I love those movies, especially if they're done seriously. So I'm really, really curious about Arrival.
All right. Well, we would not be a discussion of the Toronto Film Festival between you and I without me having a whole bunch of envy and frustration that you're there and I'm not. Because say what you will about as busy as they are and exhausting as they are, I always want to go. So I'm looking over the list, and here's some movies that jump out at me, the movies that I really want, wish I could be there to see and will be very much anticipating for once they finally get here. Because, of course, that's one of the frustrations for me. I think frustrating for probably anyone that's not actually at these film festivals is I find myself hiding from Twitter for most of these film festivals because yeah. I want to get a general vibe of okay, is it like the really bad, we talked about this in the Cannes podcast, the really bad Matthew McConaughey Gus Van Sant movie,
Sea of Trees,
or the bad Sean Penn Javier Bardem Charlize Theron movie, that movie. Now I'm like, oh, like film festivals, I guess it's useful to know, oh, that's a movie I never need to see. I said I could just knock that one off the list of movies I will ever have to go see. But for me, the frustrating part of being a film, watching these film festivals and seeing other results come back, it's like, oh man, you get to see Terrence Malick's new movie. And right. I have to wait like 3 months. So I'm going to give you a few movies looking over both your list and other lists that I'm particularly excited about that I wish I'd be able to see. One, as I just mentioned, is Voyage of Time, Life's Journey, which is Terrence Malick. We've discussed Terrence Malick on this podcast. We like Terrence Malick so much that, Prince of Burger King or whatever the name of the last movie was. And Knight of Cups.
Which is a good movie.
We
like it.
That's what I'm saying. I like Knight of Cups. We like Knight of Cups. So we're kind of Malick honks.
Yes.
But this one in particular, this is his big... But the problem with Knight of Cups, it was almost too slight. It was like it had the artistic notion of transcendence and ambition without necessarily the story that around it. This is literally about the origin of humanity. So
yes.
At the very least, it's hard to say that like no one's going to watch this movie and be like, I don't know, what's the big deal? Some screenwriter gets to date a bunch of really hot girls. Why? Who cares about that movie? You can't. It's hard to argue. This is not like, you know, this is about the literally beginning of life. Right. So,
and there's two versions of it. The one in Toronto is the it's the longer non-IMAX version. But yes, there's like a 40-minute IMAX version, and Brad Pitt narrates that one, and Kate Blanchett narrates the longer non-IMAX feature-length version of it. So it's like back in the day, Will, when there were like an album and they'd have like several different album cover types, you collect them all. Terrence Malick is doing the same thing with Voyage of Time.
All right. So yeah. So he's like the Kanye of directors. He's constantly tinkering. You never know which version you're actually seeing is the right one. I would say Kanye is probably the Terrence Malick of that. But whatever, let's move on. Another nice thing I like about Toronto, cast porn. I just like, there's certain movies you look and you're like, okay, how are all of these people in this movie? How did they, like, this movie better be good or is at least clearly built for Toronto? Like, one of the things I enjoy is just to look at a cast and be like, okay, I can't believe every single one of these people in this movie is in this movie. This year's movie is Tom Ford's Nocturnal Animals. Here is the cast. I'm not even going to say what it's about because it looks interesting, but whatever. Movie has Amy Adams, Armie Hammer, Jake Gyllenhaal, Laura Linney, Michael Sheen, Isla Fisher, and Michael Shannon. That is literally every actor I like. There's nobody left in there except for maybe Bryan Cranston, who I assume has a cameo. I think that is. And of course, now did you like A Single Man? Single Man was Tom Ford's last movie. You liked that movie.
I liked it a lot, actually. And it's been 2009 was the last time he's made a movie. So it's been a long time coming. Yeah, it was on my list of the ones I'm excited about. So I think, as a quick side note, I think this could be a big Amy Adams year between Arrival and Nocturnal Animals. You know, I feel like in some ways she's been underappreciated over the last few years. Of course, my divisive or my contentious opinion that Big Eyes is good and that she's good in it, notwithstanding, I think people have kind of overlooked her recently. I think this could be a year where people go, you know what? That's right. We do like her a lot. And so she's one of those people to kind of keep on the radar for this fall.
I'll confess I'm a little mad at you because you and I, of course, we both love Amy Adams since Junebug. Like, we are a long time Amy Adams honks. And you brought up, you just had to bring up Big Eyes, like one of her worst movies. So I'm just going to forgive you on that one. Another one that looks good to me. I've been wondering, hey, where's Oscar Isaac? Is he still buried under the X-Men makeup? Where is Oscar Isaac? Oscar Isaac is in The Promise, which is a movie with him and Christian Bale, which looks kind of interesting to me. It's about it's one of those movies where it's a love story against the backdrop of the First World War. I'm a sucker for those things, man. I'm a sucker for them.
Yeah, the thing that's interesting about that movie is it feels, with those two cast members, it feels buzzless. And, you know, I've used the word buzz a couple times in this podcast. I want to clarify this. It's not as if, like, that's what drives me in terms of, oh, what's got the buzz? I'm interested in the buzz. But what is interesting about a festival is that a certain amount is kind of necessary only to create an impression that a movie is good. And that, as obnoxious as that term is, it doesn't come out of nowhere, meaning that buzz can be generated partly because the publicist behind it or the studio behind it or the producers behind it are excited enough about it that they kind of get people really, really jazzed to see something. They create an expectation in journalists and critics that, oh, this is the one to see. And if they don't, it can sometimes create the impression that, you know what, this is a bit of a misfire. So don't get your hopes up, you know, and the fact that there hasn't been much talk about that movie leads me to wonder if maybe it's going to be good, but maybe not like, oh my God, it's got Christian Bale and Oscar Isaac. I need to see that immediately.
All right. And then just one more, and then we'll wrap up Toronto. Unless there's one last thing you want to say. If you remember, my favorite movie of the year 2000, was Best in Show.
Yes.
Best in Show was actually my favorite movie of that year. I will stand behind that pick. I think history actually looks on me quite kindly for that pick. This year, it's a Netflix movie, though, of course, it's a Netflix movie in the same way that Beasts of No Nation was the next Netflix movie. Literally the only thing that these two movies have in common, by the way, is Netflix. It is Mascots. It is directed, written and directed by Christopher Guest. It is a Best in Show type movie where there's a mascot competition. The usual crew is there. Jane Lynch, Parker Posey, Fred Willard, Chris O'Dowd is in it. Zach Woods, who seems so perfect for a Christopher Guest movie. The only thing that makes me nervous about this movie is Christopher Guest is bringing back his quirky character from Waiting for Guffman, which is going to make a lot of people probably very happy. I think a lot of people love that character. I thought that character was funny, but I would have much rather seen his North Carolina bloodhound dog guy from Best in Show. That is my personal favorite, including the six-fingered man. That is my personal favorite Christopher Guest character. So, but you're not gonna get me to not get excited about Christopher Guest making a movie about sports mascots.
Yeah, my only reservation, that reservation you already mentioned, but is it does feel slightly like Once to the Well too often, just the plot and the world of that movie. And it is funny that, you know, after his last movie, For Your Consideration, which was not actually a mockumentary, it was actually a more conventional scripted thing. Clearly he's going back to kind of what most people would agree is his strength or what his most kind of popular form is. I'm very curious about that too. That is world premiering in Toronto, but I am a little worried that it'll be, oh, right, it's a good thing that he does, but kind of the thing that you've seen before.
All right. So any last things you want to take us home from Toronto, or are you just ready to get out there and not talk to anyone other than me for the next podcast for about 2 weeks?
The only thing I would say is that one movie I could not mention in the preview because I was under embargo and couldn't even mention that I had seen it, I can now mention because I have seen it, Barry Jenkins' movie Moonlight, his follow-up film. His debut was Medicine for Melancholy. It had Wyatt Cenac in it. It was terrific. This movie is something else. It's really, really fantastic, and I'm really looking forward to us talking about it more as we go into the fall, because I think it's really something special.
Awesome. All right, Moonlight, it is. I'm excited about that as well. I'm excited about all the movies that you get to see that I don't. But I have good news. Now we get to talk about movies I have, in fact, seen. In fact, have seen fairly recently, as in the last week, because they're part of our reboot section. Grierson, what's our first reboot movie?
Our seamless transitions are amazing, by the way. I love them. our first reboot movies is 12 Monkeys.
See? More games. Games, they vegetize it. See? Yeah. If you play the games, you're voluntarily taking a tranquilizer. I guess they give you some chemical restraints, huh?
Drugs!
What'd they give you? Thorazine? Haldol? How much? How much? Learn your drugs. Know your doses. It's elementary.
I need to make a telephone call.
A telephone call? That's communication with the outside world. Doctor's discretion. Hey. All of these nuts could just make phone calls. They could spread insanity oozing through telephone cables, oozing to the ears of all these poor, sane people, infecting them. Wackos everywhere, plague of madness.
12 Monkeys, as I'm sure you know, is directed by Mr. Terry Gilliam. It came out Christmas time of 1995. It stars Bruce Willis, Madeline Stowe, Brad Pitt, and I had forgotten this, Christopher Plummer and David Morse. It came out in 1995, and I have not seen this movie since that holiday season, so 1995 going into 1996. This to me is the precursor to the let's put out Children of Men at Christmas time. It's like Universal does this. They like to put out these like dark dystopian sci-fi movies at Christmas. Directed by Terry Gilliam, it is about in the late 1990s, 1997, a horrible virus knocks out essentially 99% of humanity. It's set in a distant future where Bruce Willis and the rest of the survivors live underground. Bruce Willis is sent back into time to not stop the virus from happening, but maybe just figure out how it started. The problem is that the people who run the time travel mechanism screw it up. Rather than sending him back to 1996, they send him to 1990, where everybody just thinks he is crazy. Madeline Stowe plays a therapist who, over the course of the movie, comes to realize that he is telling the truth. Brad Pitt plays a crazy guy who might be involved, might not be involved. I'm not sure why I'm saying this, as if this movie just came out and people are not aware of the plot devices. I always...
Brad Pitt is a popular actor.
He was dating Jennifer Aniston for a period of time, and then he's now dating someone new. I'm not going to say who yet. But I always feel bad because for some reason someone has not watched this movie. I have not seen this movie since that time period. Before I kind of even talk about this movie in my own opinion, have you seen this since then, Will? Had you revisited?
Nope, I had not. Yes. I had not. I thought of it very fondly, to be honest. But yeah, I have not neither seen it nor really even thought of it all that often. And I also have not seen the series that's out now. Have you seen the series? I thought it was just coming out, but apparently it's had a couple seasons on it.
Yeah, it's when I'm flipping through the channels on the television, I see on Sci-Fi 12 Monkeys. Every time I think, oh, it's the movie. It's not. It's a TV show. And my understanding, thanks to Wikipedia, is that it is essentially the same story as the movie. Some characters are different, but the Bruce Willis character is the same, and his plot, his mission is the same. I've still never seen La Jetée, I'm embarrassed to say, which this movie is inspired by, which is kind of considered one of the seminal avant-garde short films that this movie is based on. With that being said, you said, Will, that you kind of think of this movie fondly. I have to confess, before I watched it again this weekend, I didn't look at it unfondly, but it was not a movie that necessarily stood out for me as a great sci-fi film or great Terry Gilliam film. And I have to admit that watching it again this time, I like its story and some of its themes maybe better than the movie itself. I think, we had talked about on the podcast when we did the reboot for Armageddon, that Bruce Willis was really good in that. He's really good in this. He's also really good in Sixth Sense. He had a great period from like Pulp Fiction on in the 1990s where he was just sort of killing it one after another, whether it was kind of more arty indie movies or more kind of mainstream studio movies, where he was really kind of bringing his A game. I think he's really quite good in this film. I think Madeline Stowe is pretty darn good. It made me kind of miss the days when Madeline Stowe was in movies. She was in Last of the Mohicans and a couple other things. She, of course, was in Shortcuts. She's fantastic in Shortcuts. It made me really kind of miss the time when she was in movies left and right. I have to say that my opinion of Brad Pitt in this movie has not changed in 20-something years. I remember very distinctly, because it was a time in my life when these things would make me mad, being upset that he got a Oscar nomination for this performance. It's funny to go back and watch it now because you can kind of see some of the jokier performances that he's done since then, and I would argue has done better since then. This performance to me is all tics and mannerisms, and to me it doesn't... I accept that some people will say, well, I don't think it's all tics and mannerisms, and that's fine. People can see this movie in different ways. My argument for why I think it is tics and mannerisms and why I think it's a problem is that character does not create sort of a black hole of worry for me as a film goer going, oh, wait, but he's the guy behind this whole thing, isn't he? He doesn't seem, this is always the gold standard I'm going to use, but it's not like Heath Ledger in Dark Knight where I think, oh my God, that guy is totally deranged and I don't know what he's going to do next. And I'm actively afraid of what he's going to do next. Brad Pitt, to me, in 12 Monkeys, doesn't create that kind of whirling dervish, Tasmanian devil kind of feel of, this guy is capable of anything, he's so nuts. I go, no, there's a kind of like very, like, he's in this like little box of what he's doing, and that's kind of all he's going to do. And I think that actually makes a difference in this movie in terms of the great threat of the end of humanity. In terms of watching that character and thinking, oh my goodness, how is he going to pull this off? That to me is a problem. And I have to say that, especially as I get older, I find Terry Gilliam's spell on me dissipating. I find it to be to be glib and snotty about it, this is kind of canted angle cinema where everything is just on an angle, on an angle, on an angle. I found myself wishing other filmmakers could have made this movie because I understand that there's this idea that the movie is supposed to give you the sense of dislocation and make you feel like the Bruce Willis character, that he is going insane. And so you lose a sense of reality as you watch it. I think that overall works. I think Terry Gilliam pushes it too far, which I think he just always does. He kind of can't help himself. That's his style. That's what he does. To me, I think it creates a fun kind of paranoid world, and you kind of get hooked into the idea that things don't exactly emotionally connect. When Madeline Stowe kind of falls for the Bruce Willis character, that doesn't emotionally connect for me, but there is something about the overall, we're not stopping, we're just going, spirit of it, though I think it's excessive, does ultimately win the day for me. So it was funny to go back and watch this movie and go, wow, 20-something years later, I still very much feel the same way as when I saw it back in 1995.
Yeah, I have to say, one of the problems with doing this reboot in general is sometimes it's kind of hard not to turn it into, hey, what's problematic 20 years later, which is a kind of a game to do. A lot of, we discussed this a little bit with Garden State. The hotel scene.
Yes.
Like, how in the world that possibly, like, there's no way that exists now. I feel like this movie does not take mental illness seriously at all. Like, it's really, like, it's, you're supposed to get in I'm not trying to say that, like, well, it should get into, it should meet every clinical psychological diagnosis. I'm not saying that, but certainly, you know, there's a lot of, like, boy, look at all the cuckoos. That's kind of that doesn't, I don't think, takes that seriously. I think it kind of starts with Pitt's performance, which I agree with you on. And it's funny, I was watching this movie and I was like, man, this is like it almost feels like a test run for like a sharper, dumber character, like in, for example, in Burn After Reading.
Uh-huh.
There were a couple of times, yes. I'm like, oh, this is like I'm glad he got this out of his system so he could focus it and make it sharper and make it more interesting in like Burn After Reading. In fact, I bet if you really gave Brad Pitt sodium pentothal, and do not do this, by the way, but if you gave Brad, yeah, go ahead, Brad, leave. He's like, thank you. I'm out of Grish's basement. But if you were to give him sodium pentothal, I bet he would not think this is one of his better performances. I think he's a smarter actor now. He's less, even at this time, it was very clear that he was eager to show that he was not just the good looking guy and he was not just the stud. I can do this stuff. And now even the 20 years we've seen, yeah, Brad Pitt's a pretty good actor. He can do a lot of this stuff, but here it feels like it's dialed up so much without like a lot of thought down between it. And frankly, I think the thing goes for the movie a little bit too, particularly when it comes to Gilliam. Now, I if memory serves, and I'm not actually certain about this, I saw Brazil a couple of years ago and still think it's kind of great. Are you on board with that or not?
I haven't seen it in a while, but I have to tell you, with each passing year, I get more and more nervous, because when I first saw it, I thought it was one of the greatest things I ever saw. And in subsequent viewings, I've been like, well, it's still really good, but, and I'm actually afraid to watch it now, but I still like it.
Feels-
yes.
Yeah, because this feels a little, it's funny because, you know, this came on the heels of Brazil came out in 85. Then the time you would have thought, wow, The Adventures of Baron Munchausen is the worst kind of thing a big filmmaker could go through. Like, it cost a ton of money. It was a big mess. It flopped. Like, wow, that's the worst thing any filmmaker will ever go through in his career. And of course, Terry Gilliam has had such a bad issue that they made a movie about how big of a disaster he had made with the Don Quixote. And he's now back still trying to make the damn thing. But then after that came The Fisher King, which I think probably gave him some of his best reviews, but his big financial success and Oscar, and like everybody really loved The Fisher Kings. And this is his, you know, it's funny, after this he would make Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, then Nothing Till the Brothers Grimm, and then Tideland and Dr. Parnassus and Zero Theorem, and just off into Gilliam land, like off, gone. So I don't know, have you seen Zero Theorem?
I have not, no.
Yeah, it's pretty tough to get through, I have to say. Yeah. It's pretty rough. And but for me, you know, the problem with this feels like Brazil light,
mm-hmm.
at times. Mm-hmm. It feels like a little, and there's some clever stuff. I like the idea that people that sit back in time screw up. Like, I like the fact that they're kind of obnoxious and annoying, and the idea that, you know what, in the future, there's a bunch of bureaucratic morons too. They're really annoying. That's kind of a very nice little joke. And again, you're right. Bruce Willis is very solid. He really was on like a great roll around this time. It reminded me, you know, he's obviously made, I think he's got another Die Hard movie coming out, like that junky stuff. But remind me how much I liked him in Looper and how like really good with Looper. I think how Looper, there's even parts of Looper where he is drawing on this performance a little bit. And so it reminded me how much I could really liked him and how much of a solid presence, and also how he was able to be both this kind of like burly leading man, but also vulnerable and a little scared and also a little kooky. Like like Bruce Willis is a pretty good actor, man.
Yeah.
And I feel like this movie shows that pretty well in a way that gets lost sometimes, is now he's kind of in his I think he's having a little bit of a resurgence now, but he's still kind of in his, you know, he's going to be making a movie with Nicolas Cage, I'm sure. Like any minute now, he's kind of in that mode, or the Travolta mode a little bit. I think he has a little bit more dignity than those two. But I think certainly he's a couple too many Expendables movies.
Yeah, he shows up in too many VOD things now, unfortunately. Right. And I mean, the Bruce Willis thing also, like watching Armageddon again and watching this, there is something about the quality of his voice that I was really kind of captivated by. That it's like his inflection makes you care about things that he says in a way that it gives you a sense of pathos, and that you actually actively are concerned about that guy. Like there's a sense of weakness. You mentioned kind of vulnerability, that there's something about that you want to, at least I can only speak for myself, but like I actively care and worry about what's going to happen to those characters. And I think that, you know, there's a great piece I think to be written about that during this time period, Bruce Willis was sort of the great genre actor, because whether it's the sci-fi movies that we're talking about now, or Sixth Sense, or I would also say Unbreakable, because I think he's tremendous in that movie too, that whether it was like a horror kind of thing or a sci-fi fantasy kind of thing, he was really, really good. I mean, of course, the Die Hard movies are kind of be part of his major legacy, and they deserve to be. But this thing about like him and like fantasy, sci-fi genre stuff, that he just has some sort of ability. I think he has a grounding. There's a realness to him that makes those movies feel like they're in the real world, that you actually actively buy into them, because Bruce Willis, like he did in Die Hard, makes you feel like that's a real person. I believe.
Yeah, which is funny. It's funny. I brought up Zero Theorem. That's Christoph Waltz in this world, and the movie just flies off into Never Never Land.
Yeah.
Like, it's just gone.
Yeah.
Like, he's not, there's, like, I like Christoph Waltz, but there's nothing grounding about that guy.
Yeah.
And I think that is one of the important things that Bruce Willis does in this. And you're right, in a lot of other movies.
Yeah. The other two things I want to throw in one of these things I want to see what you think about. You know, the first thing is that, you know, the Brad Pitt, you know, like, Oscar nomination. I think part of the Oscar nomination was also that thing that you talked about, I think, so well, Will, which is, you know, a lot of Oscar nominations are, that was really impressive that you played someone with this disease, because you don't have that disease. And there's that kind of degree of difficulty factor. But I think there's also that you seem really pretty, and so we didn't think you had any depth, and look what you did. And this performance in 12 Monkeys feels that way for Brad Pitt, where it is sort of a, way to go, handsome guy. You actually are a good actor. I agree completely. Now we would look at this and be like, okay, well, it's sort of fun, but it's kind of one note. And then the second thing I want to say is, when this movie came out, there was a lot of conversation about, oh, it's like an homage to Vertigo. It's an homage to Vertigo. Right. And it's funny because, you know, we've talked about Vertigo. I like Vertigo. You like Vertigo. It's kind of a reach, and it's a reach in the movie. I will say it's funny to watch the opening credits and go, oh, these are the opening credits of Vertigo. I totally didn't catch that at the time, 20-something years ago. But I was watching it this time really wanting to kind of dig into that a little bit, because it's part of the movie's reputation. She wears a blonde wig, and they watch the movie, and it's, I mean, and again, maybe I'm being dense. Maybe I'm not reading enough into it. That's why I want to throw it to you. Am I missing something there? Is there more to it than that that I'm not appreciating? I mean, I get some thematic connections, but it seems like a stretch.
Yeah, I mean, well, frankly, there's the movie's not about obsession. Like, the movie's not about obsession at all. Like, to me, Vertigo is so much about obsession. Like, I know, like, an homage doesn't have to be a straight thematic match, but for crying out loud, like,
yeah.
No. Like, I'm like, there's nothing like that at all. There's nothing. And even the wig part, you know, to me, it's, I'm still just obsessed. Anytime Bruce Willis has hair in a movie, what's the movie with Meryl Streep and, Death Becomes Her. Oh. It's the Death Becomes Her. Every time he has hair, he's just like 25% wackier.
Yes.
Every time he
has hair. Yeah, I mean, Vertigo and this movie both end in tragedy, so there's that. And, you know, since we've been kind of railing on it a little bit, you know, I did forget, I will say, to give the movie its due, I did forget the misdirection that happens. I had forgotten that it was, in fact, if you haven't watched this movie, don't listen any longer, that David Morse is the guy behind the whole thing. Though I will say that it does violate a movie rule, which is if there's a guy with a long ponytail who just seems creepy, keep an eye on him. Maybe he's somebody who you might want to just, you know.
Also, David Morse with a ponytail, man. Like, no. Like, that's not. Also, but that's also the old Ebert law of economy of characters.
Yes.
Which is the idea, like, oh, well, David Morse, he's a pretty good actor who's doing pretty well right now. He's only been in one scene. I feel like we should keep an eye on him.
See, that's the thing I couldn't remember. Was David Morse big in mid-90s? Because he's not listed in, like, is he listed in the opening credits? I'd have to go back and look, because there was a part of me that's like, oh, was David Morse not a big deal? And so you could kind of get away with him being that guy. I mean, the one thing I want to praise about this movie, the thing I like most about it is that there is a sense of how expendable, pun I guess intended, that Bruce Willis's character really is, that organization is sort of throwing him to the wolves, because when the other woman shows up at the end on the airplane, clearly they have figured it out and now are going to stop, hopefully, David Morse from doing what he's going to do. That there is this sense of, they're going to keep doing this until they get it right. Unless I misread the ending, I don't know. No. But that to me seemed what the point of it was. The idea that, oh, this guy has gone through this whole thing and he doesn't want to do it anymore, it really doesn't matter. That whole kind of cynical dark edge to the movie, I still think works really well.
All right, so that is Trouble Monkey. So I have to say I'm glad we saw it again, but I will say, I wasn't crazy about it before. I always liked it. I always liked Bruce Willis. I liked the ending. I liked the twist. But all told, I think I'm probably done seeing 12 Monkeys now.
Yeah,
I don't think I don't think I need to see the series either.
Well, I say the funny thing I was just going to say is that I feel like because the movie is just good and not great, I would be open if the series was good that they actually like maybe figured out some stuff that might be fun in there. So, Will.
Yes.
What is our second reboot movie?
Our second reboot movie is Escape from New York.
Why are we talking?
I have a deal for you. You receive full pardon for every criminal action you've committed in the United States. It was an accident. About an hour ago, a small jet went down inside New York City. The president was on board.
President of what?
That's not funny, Plissken. You go in, find the president, bring him out in 24 hours, and you're a free man.
24 hours, huh?
I'm making you an offer.
Bullshit.
Straight, just like I said.
I'll think about it.
No time. Give me an answer.
Get a new president.
Escape from New York came out in 1981. It was written, scored, and directed by John Carpenter. Stars Kurt Russell as Snake Plissken, who is in the year is 1997. New York City is a hellscape because crime has risen 400%, which is a lot, but still just like four times. I don't know if you have to blow up Manhattan because of it, but apparently in the future, crime is so bad that they have made New York City, in fact, a prison with no guards. It's just walled off. There's actually a very clever shot of the Brooklyn Bridge just going straight into a wall, which I thought was a nice touch. But basically, New York City has become this hellscape that's completely taken over by the worst criminals who are meant to fall off the face of the earth and just live there, which is to say New York looked roughly the way that I left it when I moved 3 years ago to Athens, Georgia. Into this by the way, it's also worth noting, as much as we love this town and have spent so much time there, this movie, where New York is meant to look like the worst place in the world, was actually filmed in St. Louis, Missouri.
Yay.
So
keep that in mind.
Yes. Keep that in mind when you discuss Escape from New York. But it's so sad to see, too, because it's probably like 5-year-old Will Leach would like to just, all he wanted to do was go to Busch Stadium. And it turned out, oh, well, the hellscape that where Snake Plissken has to survive in one is the place I love to see Ozzie Smith play. Anyway, so Escape from New York, basically what happens is the president of the United States, played oddly by Donald Pleasance.
Yeah, which opens up a whole other can of worm questions, but yes.
Yes.
Like, wait, what?
Donald Pleasance with an English accent, kind of. Let's just not think of that too much. But basically, terrorists have taken over his plane, taken over Air Force One, and they are crash it into New York in a kind of a creepy scene. If anyone knows, well, of course, what happened 20 years later after this movie, they crash the plane in the Air Force One into this hellscape New York. He escapes just in time, so they have to send Snake Plissken, who is this badass. You know he's a badass because he's got an eye patch. Badass former soldier, played by Kurt Russell, who has his 24 hours to come in and get Donald Pleasance out of there and save himself, his brain, from exploding. I think it's his neck exploding. Something's going to explode.
But his brain would also explode as part of it.
Yes. It would be a byproduct. It's not specifically focused on the brain, yes. But it's going
to
happen.
When this movie opened in Japan, they had the translation didn't work really well, and it translates roughly to exploding brain. So
exploding brain. Get the brain out of New York before it explodes.
Right.
Grierson, I had you ever seen, I think I mentioned last week, I'd never seen Escape from New York.
I had never, I'd seen like little bits and pieces on things, never seen it, so was immensely excited to see this, yes.
Yeah, so people were very, this has become a cult film. They made a sequel, I think, a lot of years later, and I think now they're doing a remake as our reboot questioner requested. I don't know if they did just because of her. She was very nice, Dasha from London, even though she wanted to do Stakes the Con instead. She was very nice. Maybe they're remaking the movie just because of her, but they are remaking the movie. People love this movie. It's funny. John Carpenter, I've got a thing for John Carpenter. I'm one of my things I'm a sucker for. I like DIY people. I like people who write, direct, and then do something else on the movie. Whether,
right.
whether they edit it or edit under a fake name, or they, you know, they have an eye for costume design, or in the case of this, they write the score for it. And so Carpenter, of course, wrote a very famous score for Halloween. He also wrote the score for this. I think I found this movie generally fun, but I will say it's not as self-aware as I imagined it was going to be, is probably the best way to put it. There's a couple little touches here or there. Harry Dean Stanton is kind of fun. Adrienne Barbeau, who of course is the B-movie queen of all of the movies around this time, she shows up, and that's a little wink. I think even having Isaac Hayes in it is a wink. But the movie actually is, it's like Snake Plissken is not actually a very funny character. I imagine him being like a little bit of a Weisenheimer as this is going on, and he's not. I really expected, for particularly, because kind of a thing has grown around this movie, and people have made Snake Plissken into action figures and kind of their fan fiction type of things. I actually thought this movie, not necessarily lighter, but would be lighter on its feet than it necessarily is. It's not really that funny. Snake Plissken is very unflappable. I will respect the number of things that he sees and just kind of grunts at and then goes on. But the movie is definitely very unflappable, Snake Plissken. But, and I think the movie has some good stuff in it. But I will say that I thought it still feels a little plank. I don't think the score is that great, to be honest. As much as I love the Halloween score, this feels like a horror score in a movie that should be like running and having a lot of fun. And I do think the movie's fun. It has this moment. It is also one of the great World Trade Center porn movies. Like my friend Dan Meth, who is a cartoonist, did a very famous video segment where he Basically found the best movie moments of the World Trade Center in movies that were filmed before 2001. This is a classic World Trade Center porn movie. Like, he literally parachutes onto the top of Tower 2. Like, it is, I still have that moment every time I see the World Trade Center in a movie, I kind of get a little bit of a tingle and a charge. This is a classic one, up there with maybe the King Kong remake. It's like classic World Trade Center porn movies. I do think the movie is generally okay. It's got a great setup. The idea of it is really, really well done. But, you know, by the end, they're like resolving things with wrestling fights and baseball bats and a very ill-advised wrestling match, by the way. I don't know why Isaac Hayes put Snake Plissken in this wrestling match, gave him a way to kill his strongest guy and, of course, turn everyone to Snake Plissken's side, like, immediately. Very bad strategic decision by Isaac Hayes. So I think there's good stuff in it, and I do find it kind of fun. But I have to say, I there's a little part of me that wonders what all the fuss is about.
I liked it more. I mean, working backwards, I have to say, only while watching both of these movies for a reboot, did I go, wow, these are so thematically linked, I didn't even realize. They're both partly or mostly set in 1997, which is the future in both movies. And they're both about guys.
Christ.
What?
Crying. Just the idea. I had to start crying to realize that 1997
yes.
was the year that I graduated from college.
Yes.
Was the vast future for these two.
Yes. Movies. And they're both hellscapes. And both of the main characters are going to get a pardon if they execute their mission. I was like, oh my God, these are like the same movies, basically. I kind of found this movie to be a blast until it stopped being a blast. I think the first half is really tremendous. I actually really loved the score. I'm also, like, especially Carpenter scores, I'm a big fan of. Only, like, the last year on Spotify, one of my go-to music choices is his collection of all of his, not for specific movies, but just music that he has composed over time. I think it's really tremendous. I really, really enjoy it. I think the score is actually really fun in this movie. I think the setup is also really great. It's funny to hear you talk about Snake, because it's impossible for me to watch this movie and not think about Robert Rodriguez sitting on my left and Tarantino sitting on my right, and them both just like high-fiving each other while this movie is going on. Like they're both right. Sitting on my shoulder. And I think it's really interesting. And, you know, I don't know if you've ever...
That doesn't sound fun, by right. the way, to be in that position. Right.
Well, let me tell you, it's great. You know, I don't know if you've ever watched The Director's Chair on the El Rey Network when Rodriguez sits down and talks to different filmmakers. And I think they're actually really good. And I think in the Carpenter one is quite good. And it's specifically why it's good is something that you talked about, which is the DIY quality of just figure out how to make these movies work. And watching this movie through kind of like their eyes, I was thinking, this is such a great, fun, pulpy genre thing that in their hands would be much funnier. And I think part of the reason why is I think that this is a bit of a stretch, but I think I'm on solid footing when I say this. I think people who grew up loving these movies and just kind of like worshiping these movies as opposed to, say, I don't know, Kramer versus Kramer or Ordinary People or those kinds of like, yes. like prestige movies of the time. If you loved these movies as opposed to like Fellini or Antonioni or Bergman or whatever, that you look at these movies and you think that they are massively fun. And that even though they may not be laugh out loud funny, or that the character Snake is like, he doesn't have a ton of great one-liners, he does have like snotty awesome things that he says to people when they piss him off. And I could see why people like Tarantino and Rodriguez would love these types of movies, and when they made their movies, would make them even funnier, which is my way of saying that I actually think the movie is pretty funny, but in a way that doesn't feel contemporary about how we think of these types of movies, because when one actor is telling another actor what's happening in the plot, it's slow death in this movie. Like when Lee Van Cleef is like in that room with anybody and he's explaining something, it's like, oh, yeah. Please, when are we going to get back to something exploding or somebody shooting something? That is not where Carpenter's strengths kind of lie. But the kind of like the general, like I would say, batshit crazy setup of this movie, where it's like, okay, I will just give you, Mr. Carpenter, that crime has risen 400%. Maybe it's because you have an English U.S. president. I don't know. Maybe that's the reason. But the idea that New York would ever be set up this way is impossible. But I was just like, yeah, that's fine. Screw it. That's kind of awesome. Let's just go for it. And it does also go into my much like beloved rule of movies set in the future that are like, it's a terrible future because everybody's hairstyle is awful. Like, that's how you know the future's gone terribly wrong. Everybody's hair is ludicrously, amazingly bad. I actually got a lot of fun out of this. When the wrestling scene comes up, that was around the time that I went, oh, he's run out of money, hasn't he? Because it really is. It really does feel like, let's just have like a wrestling scene, you know. But I will say my best like out loud laugh in the whole movie is when Snake hits him in the head with a spiked bat. Now, remember, Will, this was shot in St. Louis. That's probably what they had around because there was a baseball team there. So they just used the available spiked bat. I think it kind of runs out of gas. I think the ending is sufficiently okay. It's kind of got like that like great little twist at the end where it's like, yeah, he screwed over the president. That'll show him. I did find myself like losing interest as it went along. It's really fun, and I will also say, just as my last thing, it's fun to watch it in the context of the second Purge movie. That second Purge movie is such, I mean, and I think they acknowledge that, is such the template for Purge Anarchy, which I also got a kick out of and thought was fun. So I think, though, I enjoyed this more than you did.
And I like Carpenter. I'm going to be very clear about that. Like, not only, of course, do I like Halloween, I think The Thing is really good. I think Starman is not bad. I know They Live is a movie that is more self-aware and is having a lot of fun. And like, and has, you know, and maybe I was expecting more They Live out of this. You know, and listen, you know, Kurt Russell is no Rowdy Roddy Piper. But
who is?
You know, yes. Who is? But Rest His Soul, of course. But, you know, I do think that, you know, They Live has a, like, it has the pulpy stuff of this. And I wonder, it feels, maybe I'm wrong. And like, it's very possible I'm wrong in this. In that when I think of the later Carpenter stuff that I really like, you know, there is, like, They Live is a great, self-aware, while still dark and kind of scary movie. Though I also like the direction he went with, like, In the Mouth of Madness, which is a movie that I really like, that I think is probably the last really good movie he made, though I didn't see The Ward.
I was going to say, speaking of movies I saw in Toronto, I defend The Ward. I think it's quite good, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I think I remember you liking The Ward. I'm not going to defend Memoirs of an Invisible Man. And please, Fletch people, don't give us another Chevy Chase movie to see. We're begging you. But certainly, when I look, like, I think They Live is really good. I think Big Trouble is a Little China is a little good. There is more of an overt sense of humor in those movies than I think that necessarily you see in this movie. But again, it's possible I'm just wrong on this. Like, this is a movie that I think you have to get in the right headspace for, and maybe I just wasn't there. I enjoyed it. But at a certain level, Snake Plissken looks to me like a very, I enjoyed watching Kurt Russell. Like, he's so cocksure and just bad at, like, yeah, I certainly enjoy him, but I feel like I would have liked, I liked the Snake Plissken character a little bit more than I liked everything
around. My last two things is, in terms of things that are problematic, I didn't miss that, right? When he's walking through that corridor in the, I think it's the World Trade Center, that woman's about ready to get raped, right?
I think so.
Right. And he's just like, ugh. He just like walks.
Yeah, New York, tough ride.
Yeah, it's like, well, it is a prison colony or whatever. I was like, hey, Snake, you might want to help her. And then the second thing is, my entire life, I have had the Escape from New York poster like seared into my mind. Now that I've finally seen the movie, I'm a little pissed off that you never see the Statue of Liberty's head on the street somewhere. Do you know the poster I'm talking about?
Yes, of course. Isn't that why inspired the scene from Cloverfield? I think that's why that J.J. Abrams has said that's one of the reasons that him and Matt Reeves wanted to make sure to have that scene, because it's like an homage to the poster.
Yes. So.
But not the movie.
But not the movie, yeah. So that seems bad advertising. That's almost warrant of a lawsuit, I said, yeah.
Yes, but on the whole, like, listen, I'm very glad I've seen it. It's one way. Clearly, I waited too long to see it. I think is definitely clear because I understand why people like it. But even when it comes to Carpenter movies, there are others I like a lot.
Yeah, I'd be curious if you saw it in a Full House. I think you might. Some of that connection might work, and also Ernest Borgnine. I think it's almost impossible to have a movie with Ernest Borgnine at that time of his career and not have there be a certain amount of self-awareness of, hey, we're just... though Harry Dean Stanton does seem from another movie.
Yes.
Like, he truly seems... I mean, I know that's kind of his usual MO in movies, that he seems to be beamed in from another planet, but there is sort of a... When he shows up, it's like, wait, what? What's he...
Hey, how's it going?
What's he doing in there?
What's he doing here? All right, so that is Escape from New York, our second reboot movie. We thank you for giving us those. I know now a lot now, eagle-eyed listeners, because nothing escapes your eagle-eyed podcast listeners, eagle-eared, bat-eared podcast listeners will be wondering, hey, I thought they were going to talk about Teen Witch, and that is correct. Last week we did say we were going to talk about Teen Witch. Which, of course, was the movie given to us to review in our reboot section from my wife. But we ran out of time this weekend. Frankly, this podcast is long enough, so we probably needed to hold off. So we did not get a chance to get to Teen Witch this week, but we will be getting Teen Witch next week, or I will be shot in my sleep. Wow. So we will be doing... I know. Listen, it'll be quick. I'll take it. It'll be like the way that Gina Carano kills Michael Fassbender in the Soderbergh movie. I don't want to die that way. I just want to just shoot me and let me fall asleep. Anyway, so we're going to do Teen Witch next week. In addition, we also have another reboot movie next week.
And you think to yourself, just real fast, you think... What could you pair with Teen Witch?
Yeah, what is I mean, listen, you know, it's hard, really. You know, it's like I've got this wine, but what is the right cheese? Well, in this case, the right cheese. So I think the better analogy is that Teen Witch is the cheese, and the wine is Body Heat, 1981 film written and directed by Lawrence Kasdan, starring Kathleen Turner, William Hurt, Mickey Rourke, which I didn't realize until I just looked at the cast right now, Ted Danson, another thing I didn't realize until I looked at the cast right now, and Richard Crenna, aka Rambo's dad, boss, general, man. So that is
but not in this movie. He doesn't play.
Not in this movie. No. he
does not.
They're all making out, and then there's just him yelling off screen, Rambo,
yes,
because he's just lost without him. I'm curious, Chris, have you seen Body Heat?
I have seen both of these movies for the first time in preparation for this podcast. For the next podcast, I have seen them both. But yes.
So you've already seen it. Yes. I have not seen either one. I think I saw Body Heat bits and pieces probably when I was like 15 and looking for, you know, never mind.
I'm not going to cast aspersions, but that was my assumption. Yes.
Yes. So I've not seen that. So I'm excited to see Body Heat. So we'll be doing that and Teen Witch. And of course, also next week, if you're like, man, what is with all this Will just asking questions to Grierson business? When are they going to talk about new releases? Worry not, young listener or old listener or middle-aged listener, whatever age of listener you are, fret not, because next week we will be discussing Sully. So Body Heat, Teen Witch, and Sully. Sully will be the big movie that we do next. We have Pilot, who had the miracle on the Hudson back in 2008, right?
2009,
yeah.
I think. Yes. Well, I'm sorry, if you heard me laughing, by the way, I was only thinking, I cannot think of the 30 Rock episode with Matt Damon.
To me, I have a hard time with thinking of Sully, of not thinking of the Norm MacDonald joke that he did on Conan O'Brien. Just to remind everyone, when Norm MacDonald was on Conan O'Brien, they asked him about Sully Sulzberger. He said, this is great. I've been working on a movie about that guy for years, and I finally have my ending.
Yes, it's funny. I
thought it was very funny.
Yeah, I have not watched that since I've watched the movie. After we finished this podcast, I am watching that. That's my treat to myself. So yes, that is so great. So great, yes.
So, but we will be talking about Sully, Body Heat, and Teen Witch next week. And you'll be live from Toronto. You will be in another country. I don't like the fact that you're doing all these podcasts from other countries and I'm stuck here in the land of Trump.
Well, I have nothing to say to that because I have to say I'm so anxious right now about the election that I can't even think of anything. Like, Land of Trump is feeling more and more possible as each day goes by. So,
yeah. Stay away from the news, man. All right.
Done.
We're going to move on. Done. All right. Grayson, good show. Well done. We will be back next week talking about Sully, Body Heat, and yes, finally, dear, we will be discussing Teen Witch.
I have seen Teen Witch. I cannot wait to talk to you about that. I'm very excited.
Awesome. Well, I hope everyone is excited to listen to that as well. So everyone have a great week. We'll be back next week with episode 34. Grayson, peace out, man.
See ya.